Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I've got an interesting guest for you today. He happens to be my neighbor and the father of my kids' closest friends. We've had some good conversations over the past couple of years living near one another, and the more I started to learn about his job, the more interested I became in what he does, and finally asked if he'd be willing to do an episode with me to talk about something I think we should all have a better understanding of: water, life's essence, the base of our health. Do you know where your water comes from, how it gets into your home, its journey to your faucet or showerhead, or where it goes once it drops down the drain? I didn't either, and now that I know, I'm a little obsessed thinking about it, and a lot more appreciative for what I've taken for granted for so long. My guest for this episode is Thomas Pan. He works for wastewater management and treatment in both Seattle and Minneapolis, and is here to give us some insight into our clean water supply. He explains the difference between the processes in the two cities, his previous career in waste paper for Kimberly-Clark, and his definition of health. This ended up being a far more fascinating conversation than I expected. We started out the conversation talking about his growing up on a dairy farm in the Midwest and how it may have led to his career and developed his sense of environmental awareness.
Yeah, my farming background gives a whole different perspective, because I've lived on a family farm where, you know, the regulations kind of, it's viewed from a much different perspective, right? It's viewed from the hand of government coming down. And all farmers, they want to do the right thing, but they just want to get something done. So, they don't know the science. So it's interesting because they don't know the science, right? So, they're just trying to, have as much milk production as they can. And people think it's they're giving them this oxytocin, they're giving them everything else, and that's not a family farm. That's not the place I grew up. But like the antibiotics and that, they just want to see the cow get better. They just want to get them back into production. There is no pushing them till they're hobbling and doing that people think of when they think of, especially, growing up in a kind of living in an urban environment and seeing, some of the animal activists and some of the, and growing up on the farm, there's nothing like that. I mean, it's just, they're just trying to make a living.
Yep.
I can see it. I mean, because the Minnesota thing, as you bring that up, a part of what the Met Council does is they also do water testing and stuff like that. So they'll do so they do a lot of what they river quality monitoring, and they also have other sites around watershed monitoring too. So that they share with like the watershed monitoring, a lot of it is shared with the state. With the PCWA and the pollution control agency that's in Minnesota, which is another, because they're all set up differently state by state.
Yeah.
All pollution control is set up differently. So they share that with them. And then like the report that came out this week about how the Mississippi is pretty pristine above St. Cloud, but they didn't realize how polluted in their respect is nitrates and phosphoruses, which is usually runoff from farmland. So they, it from St. Cloud to Minneapolis. And yeah. So where Minneapolis pulls in it is right up at Fridley. That's where they pull their drinking water from.
Wow. So below, far below where there's actually decent water.
Well, so you gotta, because and it's not where they can't do it, and it's not where I'm not, and I don't know that much about the water side of it, since I'm in the wastewater side of it. But there is ways you can take out nitrates and phosphorus in the wastewater process, so I'm sure there is ways that they take it out. But it costs more to do that.
Yep.
And they're just trying to get a control of the point source. But getting control of the point source is hard because you're dealing with family farms and and farmers who are just trying to make a living, not realizing that because when you spray something on the ground, you just think that, oh, it just goes into the ground and nature
disappears,
takes care of it. Nature take care of it. You don't realize the
and nature filters its percentage, right? That's what it can do, but we're overwhelming the ground with,
well, how much food do we produce? We produce most of a vast majority of the world's food.
Yeah.
I mean, I was watching today and you know, our biggest food export is China. We're feeding China too. So it's not only that we're not using the ground to just feed us.
Yeah.
We're using the ground to feed the world, and it's because we have such.
So let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the to the beginning, because it's a great place to start. I mean, it's where I think when I thought about talking to you, the first thing I thought about, because I also come from a farming background. my grandparents were farmers and fed, you know, they were a giant Irish Catholic family. Mm-hmm. And you know, that part of Iowa at the time was really people who had, you know, come to the area to grow and sustain their own families and make a small business. So like that's where I think about food. And just recently in getting into some projects, my friend Dr. Aaron he was working in Dawson, Minnesota, which is like way far west, straight west of the Twin Cities, about 4 hours, I think. And he got to know this organic farmer there who used to work for Monsanto. And he came into the city one day to talk about stuff, and we went to Blue Stem, which has a lot of like pictures and articles and stuff up on the walls by the bathroom that talks about, you know, sustainability and all this stuff. And he said, you know, if they had this in a restaurant in Dawson, you know, that place would be burned to the ground because Monsanto has so much control. Anyway, so I want to get into your field specifically. What is your title? Are you still working at all with Seattle?
Yeah. So you
have a couple different titles, I'm taking it.
Yeah. Yeah. So a little bit. So I originally worked for Kimberly-Clark in pulp and tissue. So making tissue paper for 12 years.
From like what age to what age?
Right out of college. So 22 to 32, 34.
Okay.
Guess. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember my age all the time. So I got to be in that industry for a little while, which was very cool because then you get to see the consumer product side of it, which is interesting. But so I have a mechanical engineering degree. So I started in Wisconsin doing some staff engineering stuff. And then when I moved out to the East Coast, I live right near Philly. And
where did you go to school in Wisconsin?
Milwaukee okay. School of Engineering.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then you went out to the East Coast?
Yeah, yeah. So I was out there for 3 years, and that's when I first got involved in manufacturing and actually being involved with the equipment.
Okay.
And that's the first time I got involved with maintenance and getting the and that's what's really excited me is about the human interaction with the equipment, and making sense of that. And using, and this is where my career has taken me, has started to better not just efficiency and people doing tasks and stuff like that, but make sure that what the maintenance guys see is what we try to do and that kind of thing. So that's when I first got involved with maintenance, and I met my future wife when I was out in Philly. And so I had the ability to move within the company out to Everett, where there was another mill, which is just north of Seattle.
Okay.
So I worked at Everett for 10 years. And so Everett's main, the tissue process that's, so there's, I think, I don't know if I explained. So there's three main players, usually Georgia-Pacific, Procter & Gamble, and Kimberly-Clark. And their main focus had been on margin products.
And so, in Everett, just to recap, in Everett, you were where? Which company?
Kimberly-Clark.
Okay.
Kimberly-Clark. Yeah. So, And so, but Everett Mill, it came up through, so Scott Paper was around prior to 95 when they merged with Kimberly-Clark, but so they were more on the volume business. So not making margin, but making it on making money on volume.
Yeah.
And the three main players at that time were more focused on doing the margin products. So the Cottonelle, the Charmin, you know, and not focused on, they were doing the margin, the volume business, like the Sam's Club, Kirkland Signature for Costco, and that as a, like an aside stuff, they'd make that sometimes. But then when the Koch brothers bought Georgia Pacific, who was one of the suppliers for Costco, it had started a little bit, but they had started making a lot more, private industry started coming in and started because it was labor intensive to run the older machines, and most of the stuff was made in the 1960s. And so it was starting to get its show its age, but the newer machines you could run with, instead of having like four or five operators on a shift to run one of the bigger machines, they could run double the size of the machine with the automation and run it with one operator.
And what was your role as far as, like, you were the machine, you were supervising the process? Or?
So I was really, title was asset engineer, but it was so I think we went through a little bit, but the tissue making process is really in two forms. It's manufacturing, which is taking the pulp and making enormous rolls of tissue, 12-foot diameter rolls of tissue.
Yeah.
And then the other side of the process is where you make that into the logs and cut it up, which is usually converting or finishing, they call it in the industry. But so I was in Philly, I was in the finishing side, the converting side. And that would be more like little project stuff, upgrading packaging equipment and that kind of stuff like that. On the tissue manufacturing side, really, you tried to shut the machine down. We were at like quarterly, we would shut it down for 24 hours. Okay. So for the most part, it was about planning for those types of massive maintenance where you'd go in and you'd load up on your not only your own workforce, but you'd sometimes bring in contractors to work on the machine to get it all set to go for another 13 weeks. Yeah. And so it's a little bit different of planning. The other thing is, the nice thing about the tissue industry is you get involved with, as me from a mechanical engineering side, I got to get involved with a lot of steam distribution, hydraulics, and then fluids, because there's a lot of pumping of pulp and everything else.
Yeah.
So,
and this is the place that was really old, right? I mean, this factory.
Yeah, so the mill had been around since in the 1910s, 1920s is when it came around.
That's incredible.
The one in south of Philly in Chester, where I worked prior to that, had been around. It was an old soap factory that was around in the 1900s.
So what's the history of tissue? Like, when did we start using toilet tissue?
So it was about the early 1900s.
Okay.
Really, the mass production of what we know as the tissue industry didn't start until like the 1950s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. It started up in like the 20s when they started making more mass tissue, and then the Depression, and you see this gap in when they started to make machines, because all the metal processing that would go into making industrial equipment was used for the war. You see a gap of when new machines
came out. Couldn't get
parts
and stuff.
Yeah, well, and they didn't allow you to build new machines I mean, the one thing about the tissue that's a little bit different from paper is fine paper uses a lot of drums and dries the paper slowly, and they dry it. I mean, normal like writing paper is about 89% wood and about 11% water. Tissue, on the other hand, when you dry it to about 3%. So you dry it a lot more. It's thinner, but you dry it a lot more. When they started making like the premium tissues, they actually dried it even more. And then they started to have to look into especially in the South, the air conditioning and all kinds of other stuff, HVAC systems keep it dry. But
just as an aside, how do they get the lotion on the tissue?
Oh, there's a couple ways. One is so like Viva paper towels, right?
Yeah.
So I was at a Viva plant too, and there were only at that time there were two machines in North America that made Viva, because it was the manufacturing process of it is you had to have machines that in order to coat both sides, you had to coat both sides of tissue. And how you did that was one of the machines was the first half of the machine was above the second half. So that's how you'd flip the paper around to coat the other side. Oh my God. So they have to go and double back on itself, right? Since then they've started to do it more in the finishing process. So they'll, usually what they do is it's like printing. So instead of index printing, you slather a whole side of a roll and then you usually do it to the top side. Actually, no, the bottom side of the roll, because top side you drip onto the paper. So you usually do it on the bottom side, print one side, and then you have to turn the paper and print the other side.
So how is that not in terms of waste management? What's the impact of adding stuff like that? Is that considered like an additive that's harder to break down environmentally, or is it?
The lotions. Not
I'm just
as
always
much.
I'm always interested in like what my impact is.
Oh yeah. So you know how they always say don't throw paper towels down the drain, right?
Right.
Don't down the toilet. Yep. Always put them and wet wipes too, right? The reason is because in the manufacturing process we put they put wet strength additives in order to make sure it holds up against water. So they'll put chemicals in the paper. And especially in paper towels, they don't do it like some of them, like probably the high-end Charmin and the high-end Cottonelle, they do put some wet strength in just to hold it up. Like Scott Tissue, they don't. And that's why those ones say septic safe is because they don't actually put any wet strength additive into it.
So we're sort of transitioning into waste management.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
So from Everett, you move up to Seattle area. You take a job there. How do you end up there?
Yeah. So the Everett mill got shut down because they were getting a lot more pressure from private label. And the other thing that was different about the Everett mill that was the last of its kind for Kimberly-Clark at that time was it was an integrated pulp and paper mill. So we actually brought in wood chips, pulped them up, and then put them through the tissue process. Okay. What they do now is either there's pulp mills in Canada and they make big like 3x3 cardboard stock of white paper. If you see train cars, you'll see them. You'll see like GP written next to it. And that's usually you'll start to see if you know what to look for.
Yeah.
The other part of it is, so that's for, that's softwood, that's pine and stuff. For hardwood, which is actually soft, it's shorter fibers, okay, which is softer to the touch. We actually get it from Brazil, Spain, eucalyptus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's global the way they source their paper. Anyway, so with an integrated pulp mill, you couldn't. So we still got. We were trying to get some maple in and some other stuff to try and be more localized with our supply chain, mm-hmm, and not have to go to Brazil. Yeah. But it has its own problems. But and controlling quality at that point is a little bit more difficult when you start doing wood chips because you're getting the scraps from a sawmill at that point. Anyway, so it was their last one of that. And so they wanted to, there was pressure to shut that one down, which as far as environmental, they wanted to do some really interesting things, but because it was such a corporation, they wanted to stay with their core products. Like one of the ones that they wanted to try and do was, since it's a pulp mill, they actually are set up to process wood and lignin and the processes from plants. So they ferment it. So they can actually make biofuel
Oh, wow.
A lot easier than they're set up to do it. because that's what their process is.
Right.
Right. So they were looking with the University of Washington to make,
because there was money to be made.
Yeah.
By the byproduct. Right.
And they were just about to pull the trigger in 2006, 2007 to make a pilot plant and start making biofuel.
Mm-hmm.
And then the recession happened and the subsidies went away for all biofuels. So there was the payback was too long for a private company to do it anymore.
Yeah.
So they stopped it. But it was just interesting things, how things turn in cycles, right?
Yeah.
So that mill got shut down. And then I was looking for a job, and I was really involved with the shutdown of the mill, because I had been there for 10 years and knew the equipment and knew other Kimberly-Clark facilities. So I was able to move the equipment around. And our environmental manager, who was involved in the demolition of the site, because it had been around since 1920s,
yeah,
there was stuff there. There was a whole, so the mill was built on the Sound. And when I say built on the Sound, the land that was there was not really there. It was all fill that was put there when the mill was built. So everything was on pilings, and it used to have this huge kind of pond in the center of the mill where they bring the logs in, and they had that had all been filled in. So they didn't know what was there, right? They didn't know what they filled this thing with. And the other thing that kind of was hard for it was because the bay that it came into was the port of the Navy port for Everett. So they brought the aircraft carrier in there. But
100 years of anything being in one place, you find out. I helped when I started the center that I started in Brooklyn in like 2005, 2006, we did a gut reno. We had to, because we started finding all sorts of stuff. There was like fire damage in the walls. They had to like put in new support beams because they realized the fire had actually weakened like the whole center structure of the building. We found newspaper in the walls for insulation. We found they had tile with linoleum on top, with all this stuff underneath the hardwood, and that the weight of that was actually going to collapse the floor eventually. So we had to like have that broken through it. All that tile had to break through, concrete underneath it had to break through into the basement to like get that. It's fascinating.
Yeah. There was some interesting stuff, and a pulp mill is not necessarily the environmentally friendliest process.
Yeah, sure.
So I knew him, and he actually came from the city of Everett in their wastewater district before he came to be the environmental manager over at the Kimberly-Clark mill. And during that process, he got a job with King County Wastewater District. And so when I was looking for a job, it came up that they needed a reliability engineer there. And so I came in to, I filled that position. And so that's how I got into wastewater.
Gotcha. So we talked a little bit before and didn't get this on record, but so you were involved in where they had to set this up.
Well, that was before I came, because when I came, so what the job was for, the reliability engineer, was for a new treatment plant, because King County had started to move. They needed more capacity for their wastewater system.
Seattle was growing.
Seattle was growing, and it was the suburbs that were growing too.
Right.
The urbanization's starting to come.
Yeah.
But, there's different reasons why treatment plants can handle the urbanization better than they can handle
sprawl. Okay.
And so they needed to handle the sprawl a little bit more. So they wanted to build one north, and they did that with Brightwater, which is the treatment plant, which is about a fourth of the capacity of the other two, but it was made to handle the, and it was made at that point in time, it was the largest membrane treatment plant in the world. So, so membrane treatment plant, is the new technology in wastewater treatment, which is, the membranes, they're microscopic holes that you take the water through to filter out, and they can filter out bacteria. They can filter out some viruses from it.
And they're way more efficient in terms of cleaning the water than other methods had been.
Yeah. So normal, treatment process, even around the Twin Cities and the other two there, they take it, just to go, I guess we can go through a little bit of the treatment process, right? So when the wastewater comes in, and collection's a whole different thing, but when wastewater comes in to a treatment plant, they first screen out the big stuff.
Right.
The tires that come through the wastewater stream. I mean, they get amazing. You wouldn't think it could fit down the pipe and someone could get it down there, but amazingly, some things find themselves through there. But yeah, so they have, they're called bar screens, but it's just it's a big grate, and they take out the trash, and really that goes to landfill.
Okay.
And then they go through they kind of churn up the water a little bit and send it through settling tanks. And really what the job of a settling tank is, the inorganics, they try and settle out to the bottom.
Yeah.
That's right before the settling tanks, but they settle out the inorganics, and that actually gets sent to landfill too, because it's inorganic.
Yeah.
Then the next start is they settle out the heavy organics and let the scum and the fats and the oils sit on top. So they skim off the scum on the top, and the heavy organics, they send that as sludge and to solids process. So if we keep going through the liquids process, that liquid, then they send to aeration basins. So they pump a whole bunch of air into it. And really it is to feed bacteria to eat the organics that are insoluble. So they're contained in the water and they can't get it out by settling. So the bugs eat it, they die, they take that and they process that in the sludge. And then the final settling is they just let it sit with more bacteria, not any air in them. And then after that, it's, usually taken off site, and after that, they call it secondary. So, in the early days, the first part of the settling part and no aeration and bugs, that's primary treatment. And, there's cities to this day that just do primary treatment, not secondary treatment.
Really? Like large cities too?
Vancouver, BC.
Wow.
Because they were coming down and looking at us to see how they could put in secondary.
Yeah.
There's larger cities that still do it. It's just a matter of it's a lot more cost to do.
Yeah.
Because you got to pump air. You got to have huge blowers. You have to have a lot of stuff to do it.
Yeah.
So out of that secondary process, you send it out to a body of water, and usually you put in a little bit either chlorine or you do some sort of disinfection on it.
Okay.
To kill the final stuff. So in a membrane treatment plant, they take it through these filters, still take it through aeration, but then they take it through these filtering banks. And that'll get it about 7 times cleaner. So you can use it as reclaimed water at that time.
Yeah.
To use normal conventional treatment as reclaimed water for people to use on, some cities do take it back, but they have to do even more treatment on it.
Yeah, yeah.
To take it into straight into drinking water system. Reclaimed water is usually used for like irrigation, not non-potable use.
Yeah.
Although
that's still going into, you know, the ground and
in that case, what they want to do is not, and as the environmental guy who when I worked there, he said if you were in a less sterile society, you could drink the water that came out of breakwater.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a matter of our guts aren't made to do it.
Right.
So we would get sick, but it's not like it's just not used to it.
Right? Gotcha. So the ground can handle it from it's just our guts can't.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between like your role in Minneapolis now and what you did in Seattle is the process different?
The process is different in Minneapolis. So Minneapolis has 7 main treatment plants. The big one is the one in St. Paul, and that takes the majority of the metropolitan area.
Okay.
And it's all conventional. The only one that's actually new is there's one up in East Bethel, that's new. And that one is a membrane.
It's a membrane.
And that one's doing the... So why they did that one is because they're actually doing direct groundwater injection with that one.
Okay.
They're sending it right back into the ground, which... as far as, so now we can get talking a little bit about the environment, how, yeah. what we do. So, Seattle's a lot, so Seattle, you get everything, all the drinking water and everything from the mountains, right?
Okay.
And then it goes out to Puget Sound. And that's the way the treatment plants work too. So we get all the wastewater and then we send it out to Puget Sound.
And so that just like from start to finish. So the water comes,
yeah.
you know. Either it's you know, rain, it's frozen water, mm-hmm. it comes down, it's filtered to some extent by the ground, and then it ends up in the Puget.
Yep. And but the difference between so we're naturally following the water cycle pretty much.
Right, yeah.
In Minnesota,
one of the flattest places on earth.
Yeah. So you're taking all of this drinking water. A lot of it is coming from groundwater sources. Not Minneapolis taking from the river, but for the most part, these outlying communities that we're taking into these main, treatment plant, we're taking it from the groundwater and then we're putting it back into the river.
Okay.
So it's a lot different than the water cycle that we do.
Anything come from lakes, or we don't have any watersheds or anything like that here?
It matters. I'm not on the water side as much. So yeah. I just know how the wastewater side
gotcha.
We do.
Okay,
and that's,
gotcha.
That's really why East Bethel, they wanted to do groundwater injection, because if they're looking into it more about reusing, because we don't have any reclaimed water reuse okay. In the metropolitan area. They're looking at it. And the reason they are is because we're draining the aquifers
yeah.
and putting it back into the river. We're sending it down to New Orleans, right?
Yep.
We're not replenishing that aquifer. So even though, you know, the Midwest has a lot in the aquifers, there's a limit to what we can do. So they've been starting to look at it and see how they can reuse the reclaimed water to use it out into the communities. But the problem is that one of the main issues, and when they were citing Brightwater out in Seattle, they did it with the intent that they wanted to use the reclaimed water from that. So they're actually doing it in Seattle. And the siting process, so for a treatment plant, usually you want it in a low-lying area so you can just gravity feed everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't have to pump anything, right? You don't want to pump stuff.
It's trying to save energy,
yeah.
money, cost.
Yeah. The problem with that is then if you want to use the reclaimed water, you got to distribute it somehow. So you got to pump it back up, right?
Yeah.
But Brightwater, they actually put the main collection station is in the low-lying area. The treatment plant is up on a hill. So they pump all of that. They pump the wastewater 2.5 miles uphill, treat it. But now they have a charged capacity of reclaimed water that they actually don't have to pump.
Hmm.
And right now they just have a golf course, but they're starting to bring online some grass farms and some other stuff.
Yeah.
They're starting to reuse it. It's kind of funny because no one wanted a treatment plant in their backyard, right? So the siting process of that one, they were going to put it right next to the Sound on an old, the refinery's a little bit reused, but where the outfall is, which it means where we send the water out into Puget Sound, that's where one of the original sitings was going to be, but it was right next to a city and there was a road, but it was only a 2-lane road and it was kind of in a residential area. And so the problem is, the byproduct of wastewater treatment is the solids process, which we didn't go through. We didn't go through solids yet, but
yes, I was thinking about it when you were talking about
yeah.
it.
So that had a restricted access kind of, and so they didn't, really the mayors and them really fought it heavily because they didn't want all that industrial equipment coming in and out. So they sited it at an old garbage dump, a demo yard where they put old cars, and a soup factory was there too. And the funny thing was, is that the neighbors, they really didn't want it because they were fed up with the soup factory because it
stinks.
They said on French onion soup day, it was like the whole neighborhood smelled, right?
Yeah.
But when they put in, I joke about Brightwater because it's like it's an odor control facility attached to a wastewater treatment plant. Because the agreement with the neighboring community was that they would not, that so it's a 90 acre plot of land, 30 acres is the treatment plant, and the rest is all the restoration for when they built the treatment plant, they decided they wanted to do low impact construction, so everything they dug up, they kept there. So there are a couple of hills for when they dug down to create all the tanks stuff. And they also resurrected one of the streams, one of the natural streams that was going through there. So it's walking paths and everything else. And the agreement was they wouldn't be able to smell anything outside of the main 30 acre fence.
Hmm.
And so that's what they did. And since 2012, they've never had an odor complaint.
Wow.
Because you walk that treatment plant and you cannot tell you're in a treatment plant.
That's pretty surprising.
Yeah, it's only when you open the doors that you can actually that you start to smell. But other than that, So solids process. So all that sludge we collect, it goes through, and there's a couple ways that they do it. So in Seattle, they take out some of the water and they put that back into the liquids process. The rest of the sludge, they take into digesters and they digest it and they take the methane and...
Is the digesting with the bacteria?
Yeah. So they have anaerobic bacteria in the digesters that they use in order to digest and create, and it creates methane and, it breaks down all of the harmful bacteria that are in the wastewater that's in the sludge. And so the methane they use to, and actually in parts of it, sometimes they compress the methane and put it back into the natural gas system. They can do that. That's really expensive to do it that way. So normally what they do is they run their boilers off of it and heat the water around the treatment plant. And then they do the excess gas, they do flare off. If they have any, they will. But then that digested sludge, they send it through big dryers. Like you see, they're not heated, but they run just like a dryer. But they're very industrials and they're called centrifuges.
Yeah.
And you usually hear about centrifuges in the nuclear process,
right?
Yeah. So, but these ones, it's just a dryer, slings it to the side and dries it out. And so what they do with that in King County is, they will direct land apply that to some farmland. A lot of it goes back out to Eastern Washington, gets mixed with regular compost, and then they make compost out of it.
Okay.
In the Twin Cities, there's two treatment plants, one down at Empire and one out in Blue Lake, that they do the Shakopee, that they do digesters on.
Okay.
All the rest of them, the sludge they collect at each of the small treatment plants. So Hastings, Stillwater has one, Cottage Grove has one. So those ones, and when they do Empire and Blue Lake, when they're not digesting, they send their sludge back to the Metro treatment plant, which is the one in St. Paul, and they burn it.
Hmm.
And it's not in it's burned in a fluidized bed reactor, which is it's a really kind of, so all they have to do is they start it up with natural gas,
yep,
put the sludge in, and it just continuously burns. And so they don't have to add any more natural gas after the initial startup. So there's enough BTUs in poo to fire it up, to keep it going. And so it's really in cold weather environments, it's something to do, because if you had digesters and you had the sludge coming out of it, you got to do something with it.
Yeah.
Right. And so
that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, And so environmentally, talking to the health aspect of it, the land application in that has even gotten a little bit more. It's interesting because Washington has such a culture of environmentalism,
yeah,
right? That there's people who are actually against land application of human sludge because of the chemicals that the treatment process can't take out.
Right.
So there's a lot of people who are worried about that who don't like the idea of land application on farms, mm-hmm, and that produce food for humans.
Yeah.
There's been nothing that's, and it's hard to do a long-term study on that.
I know.
And so,
Cause at best we're how many years in at this point, you know, in terms of even studying it.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, I mean, you could probably, you know, I mean, there's always the business side of this. And then what you know is like the, you know, from an energy standpoint, how much it takes to clean, you know, through this process. I'm sure you can. So if you see where do you think the future of this is going in terms of efficiency and being able to deal better with the environmental impact stuff?
Yeah. The chemical ones are just, it's going to be hard because there's nothing that can strain out the chemicals, and a lot of the facial cleansers and body washes start to have exfoliating,
yeah,
which are just plastic beads.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't break down at all.
Yeah.
We're sending them right back out because we have nothing. Unless you're in the membrane process, and then we got to do something with it once we clean out the digestion.
And there are just very few of these out there.
Yeah.
Another thing I've been thinking about, just because we are neighbors, get to see sort of your day-to-day process a little bit. I've been thinking more and more about, I try to do my best as far as, you know, what I feel like I can do for my impact.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like I know very little about that. So if for anyone listening, what kinds of things could people do to sort of like, you know, help this process a little bit? If, you know, I mean, environmentalists are there to sort of, you know, hold us to certain standards, but mm-hmm, at the same time, I feel like we also, you know, personally, and I get into this with my, you know, sort of dialogue around healthcare as well, we have a role that if we knew, like, let's say three things that we could do better, what would that be?
Mm-hmm. So anything that's inorganic, never put down a toilet, never put down, because all you're doing is you're sending it to a treatment plant and then we have to take it out in the initial process and we're sending it to a landfill.
And that would be, would you consider these like cleansers and those kinds of things to be part of that?
So the cleansers are hard because you can't collect them. Right. So it's kind of it's a give and take kind of thing. I mean, one big one is like wet wipes. So baby wipes and stuff. And they say flushable. They're not flushable.
Yeah.
And the treatment process has such a hard time with them.
Okay.
Because so the one I didn't talk about was how we actually get it to the treatment plant, right? It's on the east side of St. Paul.
Yeah.
And we're collecting from the east side of St. Paul is treating everything from like Brooklyn Center up in the
north. So the entire Minneapolis St. Paul
for the most
region,
part,
right?
Yeah.
It's like 3.5 million people.
Egan's got their own. Minnetonka's got Blue Lake that it goes to.
Okay.
But as far as everything else, everything to the north, Roseville, way up in Hugo, I mean, we're conveying all of that down, and it's not all by gravity. So we take it to gravity and then you pump it back up and then you take it to gravity again. And those pump stations, they don't have bar screens. They don't have any of the screening equipment,
right,
for the most part.
Yeah.
So we're spending time going out and making sure that those ones aren't plugged up. And that's actually where you get your overflows. You don't get your overflows or any kind of sewage contamination from the treatment plants.
Yeah.
They don't, they're huge.
And I think this is interesting to talk about because most people, I think, like, and I'm sure I was, you know, I know a little bit more about process now, but we live in an area with so much water, with, mm-hmm, so many lakes. And I think some people think that, you know, we're just filtering, you know, water from all the water that's around us. And we're not realizing how much of this wastewater is being reused and how much of it needs to be reused because it has to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's actually our source. And I think it's good for people to understand this process a little bit.
Yeah. And I would say even before, for the past 5 years, I've been learning about this because yeah. I mean, even when I worked for, I didn't know what a whole wastewater process was.
Yeah.
And I mean, we were talking about this at work the other day, is that we don't teach civics anymore. We don't teach how the public sector works,
yeah.
right? We don't. And there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, people like to think that government is wasteful, but there's a lot of long-term thinking in how to yeah. do it. That pipe that was over in St. Paul, that was built in the 1910s, 1920s. It's a 14-foot diameter pipe sitting underneath 94 that we can send a boat down to inspect it, right?
Wow.
It's huge. And so I talked about the sprawl being more of an issue than the urbanization. And that's because of that, because the sprawl, we have to take care of an account with lift stations.
Right.
Urbanization, we're actually set up a lot better to do yeah. that, because
we don't have to move as much, right? I mean, it's a matter of distance. And
well, there's a couple reasons. One is because everything was combined. So it used to be that all of your drain spouts, all of the runoff from the streets and everything else, stormwater runoff, all went into the sewer system, and everything went down to the treatment
yeah.
plant. So the treatment plant used to have to handle
everything.
Like 300 MGD, so 300 million gallons a day.
Wow.
Now it's handling like 180. It's like it's probably, you know, half to three quarter capacity.
Yeah.
And so there's room in the pipes to yeah. do urbanization. Yeah. But
interesting. Well, this has been awesome talking about. I kind of wanted to like get into you a little bit for one other thing, because yeah. you're like a super avid cyclist, one of the most avid cyclists I know. Did that come out of the environmental part of the work that you did, or have you always been?
It came a little bit about. So when I moved to the West Coast, I got my first road bike when I moved to the West Coast. So I didn't start cycling until I was 25, 26.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of what I started too right? then.
And you know, I didn't do any really on the farm either, because we lived, you know, we lived a mile away from anyone else. Right?
Yeah.
So everything was, it was all car if you wanted
yeah,
to go somewhere.
Yeah.
When I started working up in Everett, it was about 10, 15 miles. And I should have ridden every day for that point, but I wasn't in that mindset yet. We had two cars. I didn't have to ride. So I'd only ride like in the nice days
right,
in
right.
summer. Right. And then when I moved down to Seattle, we moved closer to Seattle. So like right in just a little neighborhood in Seattle. And, at that point, I said, I'm going to get rid of my car when we move, because one, I don't want two cars in an urban
yeah,
environment.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of how I started.
And I
too.
Said, we didn't need it. And so I moved down there, and I had a really nice express bus I could take up to the work up in Everett. And then when I was looking for another job, and it was all reverse commute, because I was heading out of Seattle. And then when I was looking for the next job, I got the job as a reliability engineer at King County. And it was an 18 mile commute, and it was reverse, and there was no bus service that would get me up there early enough. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try try riding.
Yeah.
And so, so that's when I started back in, 2012.
You're in the, in an extreme weather environment where you can get like 100 degree days, negative 20 days. Do you have a cutoff as far as weather is concerned? Is it just ice?
And snow.
So
that was the one thing where I came out here. I was like, cause I didn't, so I got to separate it from my wife when I was still out in Seattle. And so when I moved out to an apartment, I didn't have a car. So yeah. I went car free for those, about a year, year and a half. I was car free. And so then when I moved out here, I was like, I really love to go car free. And we moved out in August. So I was car free up until.
I remember you didn't have a car for a little while.
Yeah, I was car free up until a couple months in, about 3 months in. And then I got the old car that we had. And I've tried, and so the first winter, I tried riding my regular commuting bike that I did in Seattle, and I had my first real snow going in, and I probably went down like 5 times.
Oh, that's a lot.
And
I've only gone down once, and it was a totally silly thing where like I realized it was like rush hour. I realized I had to sort of move up to a sidewalk for one point, and I had like went around something, and then I didn't see the snow plow had like sort of plowed in a sidewalk area, and I sort of hit this bank of like 3 foot of snow and tried to go through it. It just hit, and I just turned over on my side and fell into the snowbank. So, but I've seen people go down in ice before, which is a really bad wreck most of the time.
Yeah. So I was driving my first time in, and I had gone down like 5 times because it was snow, and I didn't have any kind of, it was just regular tires on a 728.
And now you have the spikes.
Yeah. So at that point I was like, screw this. On the ride home, I went to the bike shop and I said, okay. And I talked to some people about what to do for winter.
Yeah.
And they said, a couple of the avid cyclists, they said, get a fixie. And so, and now I'm riding. Yeah. I got a fixed gear. So the pedals move when in the back wheel moves, and it doesn't, And there is no coasting.
Right.
So I got that, and then I got studs. When I take the kids to school, I'll take the car because just want them. Yeah. And I do have, I have a family bike. So I have a long tail big dummy, Surly big dummy.
That thing's amazing.
And, we got that when we were out in Seattle, and it's decked out so I have a little 5 and an 8-year-old girls.
Our friends are buddies. Yeah. I mean, our friends, our kids are friends. They're best buddies.
But so they'll both sit on the back, and we'll go around wherever. And I've taken them. We'll go on 10-12 mile bike rides with that thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
And, yeah.
So what's your average weekly log of miles now that you're, 'cause you're all over the place.
Yeah, if I go. If I ride my normal week will be around, if I commute all 5 days, and usually I'll average about 3 to 5 days of commuting, and it's 18 miles one way. So I'll go about 200 miles in a week.
That's amazing.
If I do it.
I pale by comparison. So, I like to ask a lot of my guests now the title of the podcast is Health Is. At the moment, within Ellipse, I know, and want to kind of get some feedback. Mostly, I'm kind of gathering information about what people, you know, their own personal belief system around health and what they sort of develop for themselves. So, I asked you to finish the statement. Health is ..
Yeah, and I was thinking about it, and mine is just health to me is kind of living within my means. It's more, the cycling thing, and especially working for in the public domain in a kind of health environmental kind of environment, it's been a lot more of, you know, if it takes me, it only takes me a half hour longer to ride in. It only takes me, but it's consistent.
Yeah.
And to me, and I'll get out and I'll have to go run errands, and I can ride there. And it's to me, it's a lot more freeing, especially in an urban environment to ride around. But the living within my means, it's just, trying to do things simply and trying to do things within my means is what health, what I've grown to have as my definition of trying to live healthy.
Yeah. But, I like it. And the consistency part is like a huge part of things that I tend to sort of preach with people when I'm You know, I think a lot, too many times we get into these up and down periods where we decide to, like, you know, eat really healthy for a little while because, I mean, it's just past New Year's resolution time. Like, I go through this with everyone. It's like, cutting this out, doing this. And I really think it's, you know, there's a certain amount of moderation built in if you're consistent. You don't really have to think about that part if you've already built that part into your lifestyle. And that's, I kind of appreciate that about the way that you go through things. So, cool.
Thanks.
All right, man. This was fun. Yeah. If anyone has any questions, you can contact me. I have my my email up on the website. If you got any questions for Tom, maybe we can do a follow-up.
Yeah.
And until next time, be well.
Thanks.
Pretty interesting stuff. Some things in there I perhaps didn't want to know about the reuse of water, but it makes sense. There's a finite supply of resources on the planet, and water has to rank up there near the top of those we need to protect. If you've seen the movie The Big Short, you know that Dr. Michael Burry, the guy that Christian Bale played, who figured out the banking industry was bound to collapse from its lending habits, which it did in 2008, is now investing in water. Without getting too gloom and doom, I think the lesson to be learned here is that we take a lot for granted. And the better our understanding of how our world around us works, the more connected we are to the source, in this case, water, the thing that makes this planet inhabitable. Without it, we don't exist. Thanks so much to Tom for taking the time to meet with me for this conversation. I really like his take on health, keeping it simple. It's a good reminder for all of us. Something simple I like to start with when I'm treating people with acute and even chronic conditions is to develop a habit of water consumption. Most data suggests about 64 ounces a day, give or take, based on your activity level, size, climate zone, etc. And I find that this simple shift alone can often decrease the symptoms of chronic pain, discomfort, GI issues, and a host of other things. It's a simple test to see if hydration is part of your health challenge. Also, cost-free. Please post your comments to me and let me know what you thought of this topic. Looking forward to hearing from you. Until next time, be good to your planet. Be kind to each other. Take care of yourself. Be well, my friends.